Hi, Sharon Davis with you. Welcome to Hindsight. Today, a new and illuminating look at one of the fathers of population theory, the English political economist Robert Malthus. His essay on the principle of population was first published in 1798, and another seven editions were to follow before his death in 1830. It's these later versions which, as you're about to hear, play a key role in the new perspective uncovered in today's program. Australian historian Alison Bashford was familiar with Malthus's essay, and while doing some research in the United States, she just happened to pick up an 1803 edition that was, unusually, unabridged. What she discovered in those extra chapters led her to realise that, along with many other scholars over the last century or so, she'd misunderstood both Malthus and the breadth of his vision. This realisation came through a couple of extra chapters that Malthus added to the 1803 edition, which dealt with the question of population in both North America and, most surprisingly of all, in the relatively young colony of New South Wales. It's this colonial context, the new worlds of Australia and North America, says Alison Bashford, through which we can take a fresh look at Malthus's writing and the man himself. Here's Malthus and the New World.
An essay on the principle of population as it affects the future improvement of society, with remarks on the speculations of Mr. Godwin, Monsieur Condorcet, and other writers. Printed for J. Johnson in St. Paul's Churchyard, 1798.
You know, I think of discussion now as cautious about moving beyond one's own very precise set of knowledge. Mm. And this is quite unfamiliar in the 18th and even in the 19th century, and it's one of the reasons I rather like thinkers from that time, is that the drive to actually make connections and see large pictures was something that drove them. So far from being kind of cautious about it, this really was their encyclopedic mission and their drive.
There are many parts of the globe, indeed, hitherto uncultivated and almost unoccupied. But the right of exterminating or driving into a corner where they must starve, even the inhabitants of these thinly peopled regions, will be questioned from a moral view.
Malthus argued in what was quite a short document initially, the 1798 essay, which was published anonymously. He was responding to both French and some British thinkers who imagined a utopian future society where poverty did not necessarily exist at all. And Malthus's argument in that initial text was that there will always be poor amongst us. And he didn't actually base that on a religious observation at all, although, like most people who were going through Cambridge at the time, he was highly trained theologically. His argument was based on a ratio that he saw between the possibilities of food production and the possibilities of the reproduction of humans. And so he said that the reproduction, human reproduction, would always outstrip the possibilities of food. So countering the people who said we are able to reduce poverty, he said there will necessarily always be a group of people at the line where population meet resources. In later editions, he said that this would be mitigated. So there were ways in which you can minimise the number of the poor, but he nonetheless always argued that the capacity or the power, as he would put it, for humans to reproduce could never be matched by the power of land to produce food.
Chapter 11. Mr. Godwin's conjecture concerning the future extinction of the passion between the sexes. Little apparent grounds for such a conjecture. Passion or love not inconsistent either with reason or virtue.
He comes to be caricatured as extremely conservative. He was opposed to the controversial Poor Law, for example, the new Poor Law. So he gets pitched often as ultra-conservative. Actually, at the time, it's not that clear at all. He has many positions on many different topics. He was anti-slavery, for example. But certainly he, at the time and since, was strongly opposed to the position of what eventually comes to be a 19th century socialist line of argument. And that's the context in which he's writing in the late 18th century. He's writing against, in the context of the French Revolution, he's writing in the context of against the British 1790s radicals like William Godwin, like Mary Wollstonecraft. They're the people who lived and wrote against convention. They're the people who had children out of wedlock controversially and were willing to stand up to all kinds of conventions. This is the exciting, radical anarchist, they call themselves libertarians of the late 18th century, that have really gripped the imaginations of generations. And by contrast, you know, quite shy, retiring Malthus, with his hare lip and his cleft palate and his theological training and his position as a parson, although that's way overplayed, simply doesn't come down to us as anything like the exciting figure of the others.
Chapter 19. The sorrows of life necessary to soften and humanize the heart. The excitement of social sympathy often produce characters of a higher order than the mere possessors of talents. Moral evil probably necessary to the production of moral excellence.
First edition was this small summary. It's really, you know, an executive summary before the fact, in a way. It was produced in 1798. Then, because there was such a strong reaction to it, Malthus went back to the drawing board, gathered a huge amount of data and new evidence, what he thought of as new evidence, vastly increased it, and produced in 1803 the second edition. And it was that long edition that then he refined over many years. There were six editions in all. The biggest difference is between the first one and the second one. In 1803, the second edition. And then in 1830, he produced what he called a summary. And he said that this is my last word. This is the last word. The last time I'm going to summarize, the last time I'm going to put this argument, I have changed my views over the years. This is my final word on population. And that was published in 1830. So there were six editions plus a final summary version.
An essay on the principle of population, or a view of its past and present effects on human happiness, with an inquiry into our prospects respecting the future removal or mitigation of the evils which it occasions. T.R. Malthus, published J. Johnson, London, 1803.
This book, the essay, is really one of the most studied texts in English history. Economic historians go to it, agricultural historians go to it, medical historians go to it. It's an extremely well-known text. What happens is that because the 1803 edition, the second edition, was so vastly longer than the first one, publishers tend to reproduce the first short, nice, slim, inexpensive to reproduce first edition. And students and scholars, even some really serious scholars of Malthus, will often use that first edition. Everybody knows anything about Malthus, knows that there are many editions, as did I in this work that I've been doing recently on population. Everybody knows this. So it's not in any sense a rediscovery. But there's really a publishing story as well. Publishers like the very small 1789 edition because it's cheap to reproduce. The 1803 edition is really, really long. And what most series editors and publishers have decided to do over the years is to heavily abridge it because it's so long. And the first thing that goes...
Chapters 3 to 14 omitted from this edition.
often chapters 3 to 14 are very often the first things that get wrenched out of the republished long 1803 edition, simply because it's too expensive to produce in full. So many libraries all over the world, many scholars rely on a very heavily abridged long version of the Essay on the Principle of Population, as did I for many, many years.
A new edition, very much enlarged.
And I was recently in Houston, Texas, which is a very unlikely location to read Thomas Robert Malthus. Mm. But I was in Houston, Texas, looking at the wonderful papers of 20th century Malthusian Julian Huxley. And when I was waiting for the archive section of the library to open, I had a couple of hours to kill, and my inclination these days is always, only historians would ever find this exciting, to go straight to the economic history shelves to see which edition, which version of Malthus's Essay on the Principle of Population is on the shelves.
Preface. In its present shape, it may be considered as a new work, and I should probably have published it as such.
And so I was very happy at Rice University, Texas, in Houston, to find a fairly rare complete edition of the 1803. And I literally was passing time, because I thought I'd read this essay back to front, inside out, over many years. I was just passing time, flipping through it, waiting for the archives to open.
Chapter 3. Of the checks to population in the next scale of human beings, we may place the inhabitants of who inhabit the seacoast depend almost entirely on
a native with his child,
surprised on the banks of the Hawkesbury River by some of our colonists, launched his canoe in a hurry, and left behind him a specimen of his food.
And literally as I was flipping through it, I saw the word Hawkesbury
River,
and I thought this was Lord Hawkesbury. And it took me only an instant to realise that this was the River Hawkesbury that Malthus was writing about, which, you know, it's a river, in fact, that I more or less grew up on. So it was one of those very strange moments where I thought, Hawkesbury River, why on earth is Malthus in 1803 writing about that?
From a piece of water-soaked wood, he had been eating a large worm. These worms, in the language of the country, are called carbro.
It's not that this is unknown, it's more that it hasn't, I don't think it's been fully appreciated, that in fact the first chapter of what is often abridged of this edition is almost all about the fairly new colony of New South Wales. And it's then that perhaps I even knew this in some distant other project, but suddenly it struck me as utterly important and vastly underappreciated that Malthus in fact had worked through this new edition, starting with the Australian instance, starting with the new colony of New South Wales.
Chapter 3.
Chapter 3, that I've become so fascinated by, the 1803 edition.
Of the checks to population.
He called Of the Check to Population in the Less Civilised Parts of the World and in Past Times. And Chapter 3 was his first go at providing a whole new set of evidence that he thought substantiated his theory. And it has an opening paragraph that very briefly talks about Tierra del Fuego and Hottentots in southern Africa in one or two sentences. Then he has a small paragraph where, rather amazingly, he talks about Van Diemen's Land and Aboriginal people there. And then the whole rest of the chapter is about Aboriginal people in the fairly new colony of New South Wales.
By what means are the inhabitants of New Holland reduced?
The chapter deals with, he's not interested at all in this chapter in what the British are or aren't doing in New South Wales. That's not the purpose. The purpose is to have a good think about Aboriginal population. How, he's trying to ask, does Aboriginal population keep itself down to the level of subsistence that is available?
The narrator of Captain Cook's first voyage, having mentioned the very small number of inhabitants that was seen on the southern coast of New Holland, and the apparent inability of the country, from its desolate state to support many more.
So he's quite interested in practices of birth and practices of death and cultures of food gathering and eating. So Malthus, all the way through his essay, is interested less. People often understand him as a writer on overpopulation. Mm-hmm. This is completely incorrect. He's a writer who is much more interested in how populations are minimised, how they are kept down.
An absolutely exclusive right in the first wife to the conjugal embrace seems to be hardly probable. It is possible that the second wife
might not be allowed to rear,
which can only be accounted for from the very severe hardships which they undergo.
So he's interested in this chapter on Aboriginal people in Sydney. It's quite specific to Sydney, in how many of what kinds of sexed infants are born, how they die, what happens. For example, he relays information that he gets from various sources here about how, if an Aboriginal woman dies, so the British source tells him, if there is what he calls a suckling child with that woman, the child will be buried with the dead mother.
In the year 1789, the colony was visited by the dreadful epidemic of smallpox. The defoliation of great numbers of the natives that it occasioned was almost incredible.
He's interested in burial and funeral rites. He's interested in war. He's interested in various kinds of tribal warfare. He's interested in whether people starve or not. He's interested in epidemic disease. So how many people are born and how and when people die is Malthus's central question. And that all becomes important to him around the question of how much food is or isn't available. So he actually goes into an extraordinary amount of detail as he receives it from various sources as to what Aboriginal people were eating, how much food was available. He writes in this chapter, in this whole section, about pre-cultivation economies. So he's very interested in first New South Wales, then Pacific South Sea Islands, and then North and South America as instances of pre-agricultural economies. What fascinates me is the level of detail, leaving aside the question of right or whether it's right or wrong, the level of detail and the way in which the reader of Malthus's essay on the principle of population is brought right to the spot. He writes about encounters between British people and Aboriginal people on the shores of the Hawkesbury River. He talks about Aboriginal people by name, which is extraordinary. And another thing that immediately grabbed my attention when I first started seriously thinking about these chapters. So there's a strong presence of not a generic Aboriginal population, but in fact very particular Aboriginal people. It's early ethnography, early anthropology. It's in a way one of the unlikely sites of a lot of anthropological detail in a text that anthropologists wouldn't normally expect to look to, which is all, of course, secondhand. Mm. Malthus never came to Australia, but his library is filled with the classic 18th century travellers' accounts. It's filled with the work of Cook, of Vancouver, of La Perouse, of, in this instance, David Collins, which is where he's getting all of the extraordinary detail from.
The account which Mr. Collins has given describes the natives as, in general, neither tall nor well made. Their arms, legs, and thighs are thin. In the last settlement at Port Jackson in New Holland, a melancholy and affecting picture is drawn by Mr. Collins of the extreme hardship which, for many years, the infant colony had to struggle with before the produce was equal to its support.
Large grubs which are found in the body of the dwarf gum tree.
David Collins, an account of the English colony of New South Wales,
with remarks in the dispositions, customs and manners of the native inhabitants of that country, published Cadell and Davies, London, 1798.
David Collins is the very important magistrate in the early colony of New South Wales, and he wrote two very large, expansive, extremely important volumes on the colony. And they are filled with detail. They're filled with very important plates and engravings so that people back in London and elsewhere in the empire got a very immediate sense of what's going on. The appendix to David Collins's work is what Malthus used. And in it, that's where David Collins absolutely goes to town in recording in very, very close detail what he observed. And it's that material that that Malthus sometimes reproduces verbatim, though happily for scholars of Malthus like myself, Malthus was actually very good in citing his sources. So Collins is his main source. But Malthus also used Cook in a way that I don't think is recognised enough at all. It's Cook that he uses on Van Diemen's Land in particular.
In a country where the inhabitants are driven to such sustenance, where the supply of animal and vegetable food is extremely scanty, and the labour necessary to procure it is so severe, it is evident that the population must be very thinly scattered in proportion to the territory.
In a way, what I'm interested in is what the whole question of colonial land and Malthus's interest in colonial land means for the history of population and for economic history and so forth. So it's really that economic historians, I don't think, have grasped or appreciated the colonial dimensions of the question of land for cultivation and colonial lands and so forth as much as they should have, and indeed as much as Malthus himself did at the time. What's really fascinated me, what really made me sit up when I reread this material, on the one hand, there was the familiar material to me that Malthus wrote about Bennelong, the Aboriginal man, that Malthus wrote about and names Colby, the Aboriginal man, is for us in Australia in and of itself, I think, quite interesting. Politically, and in terms of a revisionist approach to Malthus, the really important chapter, I think, is the chapter that comes next in this 1803 edition, which is on North America and South America. And he writes about native people in North and South America. And at that point, in 1803, there is, of course, already the deep, deep problem of how land will be cleared in the new United States, the old 13 colonies, for the cultivation of grain, for the feeding of and the very quick reproduction of British Europeans in the east coast of America. It was high on many, many agendas that the land was already occupied, of course. It was in no sense understood to be automatically available, but that in fact a delicate and difficult process had to be undertaken whereby Native Americans would be shifted off the land, removed from the land, essentially in order to make space for the agricultural economy of the new United States of America. And this is something that, you know, deeply engaged, of course, the people on the ground and up and down the administrative tree in this early colonial period of American history.
Thomas Jefferson to William Henry Harrison.
March 4th, 1804.
When they withdraw themselves to the culture of a small piece of land, they will perceive how useless to them their extensive forests and will be willing to pair them off from time to time in exchange for necessaries for their farms and families. In this way, our settlements will gradually circumscribe and approach the Indians, and they will in time either incorporate with us as citizens of the United States or remove beyond the Mississippi.
What becomes absolutely critical, I think, in rethinking Malthus is what he says about this. This process of removing people off land in order to make space for British Europeans is something that troubled him deeply. So he says at various points in a couple of chapters, especially the chapters where he's talking about North America, but not only, that the original inhabitants should not be driven into a corner, he says, where they will starve, that this is an exercise, that this is an outcome that cannot be considered for an instant. So Malthus in 1803 was deeply troubled by the process by which land would and people would be cleared in order to make space for the cultivation of grain. And this is something that he thinks about most directly with respect to North America, not something that he yet thinks about with respect to the colony of New South Wales, because it was not yet in 1803, really, there was no pastoral expansion as yet. It's quite interesting that Malthus doesn't imagine the continent of Australia as yet available for a pastoral expansion. He understands it for what it was at that point, which is a very local, coastal settlement. So this whole question of what happens to original occupants, to native occupants of various New World lands, is something that he's concerned about with respect to the American instance in particular. And it's that he has not that many, but three or four times in these early chapters of the essay, he's quite clear that driving natives into a corner, which is the way he puts it, is an extremely problematic undertaking and something that he says we should not consider for an instant. And that Malthus has often over the years been understood, often in a very knee-jerk way, as essentially a conservative. This is not what we expect Malthus, the received Malthus, to have said.
Observations concerning the increase in mankind. Benjamin Franklin, 1755. Were North America empty of other inhabitants, it might in a few ages be replenished from one nation only, with Englishmen. We have so fair an opportunity to do so by excluding all blacks and tawnies.
His whole essay, in fact, and not just those chapters, was inspired in large part by Benjamin Franklin's work. So in 1751, and this is not in the least unknown, this is fairly familiar, I think the colonial significance of it is underappreciated, but the fact that Franklin was an inspiration for Malthus is fairly well known. But it's nonetheless an interesting story. So in the 1750s, Franklin writes a short essay about the state of the 13 colonies, and Franklin had at that point been quite astonished by the rapidity of reproduction of the British in the 13 colonies of the eastern continent of North America. And Franklin in the 1750s had said, look, when there's all this room available, when there is room and land available, it is possible for human populations to double in 20 or 25 years, is what Franklin says. And this population growth rate of any given population doubling, not by immigration, but by what Franklin called natural generation, that any given population could double in 25 years was, at that point, absolutely astonishing. This is a growth rate that they understood to be enabled by the fact that there was fresh land available, that there was room to expand. But we have to remember that in the 18th century, the phenomenon of population growth it was only just beginning. So when Franklin were writing, and even when Malthus was writing, he's not writing about a world in which rapid population growth actually happened. He's writing about a world in which populations were kept steady, were kept down. That's the phenomenon that they were all interested in. So when suddenly Benjamin Franklin in colonial America looked around him and did a few numbers and saw that in the 13 colonies the population was doubling every 25 years, this was a phenomenal new thing to consider. And that's one of the derivations of Malthus's interest in the New World, essentially. So Malthus himself said, look, you know, British population hasn't really changed much since the English Revolution. He understood British population to be fairly steady, even though we know in retrospect that he was writing just on the cusp of a phenomenal population growth in Britain and Europe. Malthus didn't see that at all. So he was astonished to read Franklin on this doubling of, this very quick doubling of populations. But the interesting point is, I think, that Franklin and Malthus and others understood land, clear, fresh land, as the requirement for this doubling population. And in those generations, it was, and this is the thing that I think sometime over the 19th and 20th century this came to be normalised, but for them it was never presumed that the land was clearly available for them. It was always a problem as to how the original occupants of the land would be, or could be, or should they be, actually moved away. So what I've become quite interested in is how that process by which land would be literally cleared of people was upfront for Franklin, and it was upfront for Malthus. It was something that they both talked about very directly. Malthus was more troubled by it than Franklin was, and it's Malthus's troubled response to this that I'm actually quite interested in. And when over the 19th and 20th century Malthus gets written about, it's really the later commentators and the later historians who themselves almost take for granted that the land was just available. Malthus himself did not take it for granted, and nor did someone like Benjamin Franklin take it for granted.
Should any tribe be foolhardy enough to take up the hatchet at any time, then seizing the whole country of that tribe and driving them across the Mississippi as the only condition of peace,